Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Today, the U.S. launched what the military is calling the largest air assault in Iraq since the invasion, targeting insurgents north of Baghdad. The assault comes as the White House releases the 49-page National Security Strategy Report, which identifies Iran, not Iraq, as the single greatest danger to the U.S. and reaffirms preemption as the watchword of American foreign policy. Later on the program, a general will caution against military action in Iran. But first, Carla Robbins, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Carla, what does today's report say about Iran?
The thing that really stands out is that it identifies Iran as the country that may pose the single greatest threat to the U.S. And that's quite a change. And, you know, they haven't done this one in 4 years. It is an annual statutory requirement, but this is the first one since they've done the famed preemption National Security Strategy Report in 2002. And this one, as I said, identifies Iran as the country that may pose the single greatest threat, and it also reserves the right for the U.S. to launch preemptive military strikes if it feels that it is gravely threatened, particularly by terrorists or states armed with weapons of mass destruction. So they're not backing off on that one either, despite the failures to find WMD in Iraq.
And how does it characterize Iran? What words does it use?
Ally of terror, an enemy of freedom, an enemy of Israel, a lot of things that actually, probably going to get a lot of phone calls about this one, but a lot of things that are probably reasonably accurate. But it focuses a good deal on Iran's nuclear weapons aspirations, and one does get the feeling that that sort of is the bottom line issue here for the administration. At the same time, they do go out of their way, and the National Security Advisor, Steve Hadley, who was the principal author of this, with whom I spoke yesterday, did say that the U.S. is still committed, as the report does, to a diplomatic solution, that they support the now nearly moribund European-led negotiation efforts, that they're going to continue to work through the UN process itself. But it also warns that if this diplomatic effort fails, that there could be confrontation. This administration, I don't think that they're sitting around planning a military attack on Iran right now. I think they truly are trying to work through the diplomatic. I don't think they've gotten to the point of asking themselves the question, you know, what are we going to happen if someone tells us that they're 6 months away from having a nuclear weapon? And it may very well be that they never have to even get to that point because they don't have, you know, they only have a couple of 2.5 years left. And there's a great debate in the intelligence community about how long. It's interesting, though. The White House has two timelines. They have an interesting little PowerPoint presentation that they do, not publicly, but I'm told, in which you look at the two timelines. One is the timeline for quote-unquote regime change, meaning an internal change. They're not using the regime change language, meaning they're going to knock over the government of Iran. And there's a timeline for that, and there's the timeline for how long it would take for them to actually get a nuclear weapon, given the track that they themselves are on. And usually what ends up happening in those calculations is that Iran gets the weapon before Iran gets democracy.
You mentioned that there's more talk of diplomacy in this report. Is there also less of the military? We understand that some of the passages that vowed to keep U.S. military forces strong enough to dissuade any and all enemies from attack have, this was in the previous report, have been removed from this report.
Yeah, that was, it's so interesting to go back and you look at the 2002 report, because one of the things that really focused people's attention was this notion that the U.S. was going to be the strongest military power so we could dissuade rivals, potential adversaries, and implicitly maybe even allies from thinking about trying to catch up to us militarily. And it seemed like a proclamation of some sort of a Pax Americana at the time. That phrase is not in there, and there are many phrases that are repeated because each of the sections actually has a précis from the previous report. That phrase itself is not in there, although in the cover letter from the president, he says, we must maintain a military without peer, dash, yet our strength is not founded on force of arms alone. And I think this, once again, I think that gives you a sense that is tonally different, that this is an administration that has learned with time, as all administrations do. It's some of the things are no longer need to be there. When I asked about this, talking to a senior administration official about this, the reaction was, well, you know, we don't have to say this because that's what we've done building up our military. You know, we don't have to remind people that we have a military power so big that nobody could even dare to think about catching up with us. And the other thing I think we need to talk about is that in the cover letter, it begins with the statement, America is at war. But that refers to the war on terrorism. And that, in many ways, was, of course, the defining point of the 2002 report, which came only 12 months after September 11th, but also set up to a certain extent, the war in Iraq itself. So you have a lot of these things still in there, but I think overall, tonally, it is a slightly kinder and gentler report, despite the rather harsh tone on Iran.
Carla Robbins, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Carla, thanks so much.
Enjoyed it.
Hundreds of people in the Serbian capital of Belgrade are lining up today to pay their final respects to Slobodan Milosevic, whose flag-draped coffin is on public display at Belgrade's Museum of Revolution. But authorities rejected demands that Milosevic be buried with state honors at a prominent cemetery. Instead, he will be buried in his hometown this Saturday. The late Serb leader died 5 days ago at a UN detention center in the Netherlands, where he was standing trial on 66 counts of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes because of the conflicts in Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Kosovo. Milosevic presided over four Balkan wars that cost 250,000 lives and ultimately led to the breakup of Yugoslavia. Well, joining us with more is Dejan Anastasijevic, a writer for the political news weekly Vreme. He's in Belgrade. And Dejan, can you describe the scene there at the Museum of Revolution?
Well, there are really a couple of hundred of people there lining up to pay their respects to Milosevic. These are the supporters of Milosevic. But, you know, Belgrade has 2 million inhabitants, and it's a big city, and hundreds of people lining up for something is not really, you know, a very impressive sight.
How is most of Belgrade and Serbia reacting to the fact that his body has been brought home?
The prevailing feeling is that everybody, even Milosevic, has a right to a decent funeral. The government took a position that a decent burial is not necessarily a state burial and did not succumb to the demands of the nationalists, who even threatened to topple the government if they do not indulge them. The government stayed cool under pressure. They said, yes, you can have a normal funeral, a private event, but we are not going to help you exploit Milosevic's death for your own political benefits.
Well, he left Serbia in disgrace in 2001 after a popular uprising, and after his arrest, his return was pitiful. By all reports, his coffin just sort of clanking down a conveyor belt when the plane landed. Will his death do anything to the politics of Serbia?
I don't think there will be any long-term consequences at this point, except for the fact that this was really bad for the tribunal and embarrassment. And the government, who is now hardly pressed to arrest and deliver General Ratko Mladic, one of the most important war criminals from the Bosnian War, may now find it much more difficult to actually do this.
Because he's reported to have been ill as well, and he might die.
Exactly. He's been reported to have very high blood pressure, just like Milosevic. So imagine just the embarrassment if the government did find and arrest Mladic and delivers him to The Hague, and 2 days later he's dead.
Feeding the rumors that The Hague was complicit in his death.
Yes.
Serbia, under Slobodan Milosevic, pretty much waged war. What does Serbia do now? I mean, what is the engine that's driving Serbia?
Well, it is hard to say what's driving Serbia, but I think it's an overwhelming desire, I would say, by most Serbs, that they've had enough. They feel that the world has not treated them fairly, and they want to live like normal people, like everybody else. But things keep on happening here, you know, traumatic things which are reopening the old wounds, and it's really difficult sometimes.
Well, we're going to talk with some people who live in the region about just that in just a moment. Dejan Anastasijevic, a writer for the political news weekly Vreme in Belgrade. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, the irony of Milosevic's legacy is that his campaign to create a greater Serbia created a smaller one. Milosevic came to power in 1989 as Yugoslavia was disintegrating. In 1991, Slovenia and Macedonia broke away in relatively peaceful manner. But when Croatia, then Bosnia-Herzegovina, declared independence in the early 90s, Milosevic launched a bloody conflict that lasted through 1995. Today, the country of Serbia, Montenegro, is the final remnant of the former Yugoslavia, and in May, Montenegro is expected to vote to dissolve that union. And the Serbian state may shrink even more later this year as the final status of Kosovo is decided. Kosovo is a province of 2 million people that's been run by the UN since 1999, when NATO bombing drove out Serbian forces accused of atrocities against ethnic Albanian civilians. Most of the Serbs who lived in Kosovo have left the region. The remaining 100,000 now live in ethnic enclaves. Slavisa Mladenovic is a 28-year-old 30-year-old Serb who works for an international organization in Kosovo's capital of Pristina. He joins us now on the line from his home just outside of Pristina. And Slavisha, on television, we see these images of people in Serbia holding Milosevic's picture in reverence. How do you see Serbs reacting to his death?
People are divided. Some admire Milosevic, glorify him. Others claim they're Democrat and they're happy that he died. I think that those holding pictures and glorifying Milosevic are nowadays a minority in Serbia. Because it's been 6 years since he's not in power, and the daily problems that Serbian nation is still facing, like the economic development and different crises, are making people forget him and concentrate on their daily issues.
Well, but as you said, though, many, it might be a small amount, but they do revere Milosevic as a hero whose quest for a greater Serbia was thwarted by the West. How do you feel about Slobodan Milosevic?
Well, I have mixed feelings. I don't like Milosevic, but in a way, I like the time when he was in power, in the sense that I had more freedom.
Oh, so you're saying that you didn't admire Milosevic, but you feel in the aftermath of Milosevic, it's gotten worse?
Exactly. For the Serbs in Kosovo, it definitely gotten worse.
Some would say that's Milosevic's fault because, you know, of the wars that he carried out. That the situation is worse.
I don't think so. You can say that for maybe for 99 itself, or maybe for 2000, but nothing has really improved since then. So you can't say that he's guilty for what is going on now, because it's been 6 years under international community and so-called democratic governments of Kosovo, and people are still denied their basic rights. You can't say it's Milosevic's fault now.
So you're saying it's the international community that you blame?
Definitely. People here are not satisfied with the treatment by international community.
Well, tell us, what is it like for Serbs now living in Kosovo?
Life is still difficult. Security is definitely a weak point of what the international community provided here in Kosovo. There was never enough security for Serbs. There was always killings. Only a minority of Serbs travels around Kosovo, and most of them stay in their hometowns and don't really go out very often.
Slobodan Milosevic will be buried in his hometown about 30 miles southeast of Belgrade on Saturday. How will you spend that day? Will you watch on television? Will you mark his passing?
Well, that will be probably 10 days after he died. People will be curious. They will probably watch the television, but people will not spend the whole of their day talking about it. People have problems here. People have to go back to their work, their daily problems, their future. Milosevic is past now, definitely.
Slavisha Mladenovic, a 28-year-old Serb who works for an international organization in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. He spoke to us from his home. Slavisha, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, while Slavisha and others believe that most Serbs want to forget about Milosevic, there are some people who cannot. Next, a Muslim from Bosnia-Herzegovina who escaped the massacre at Srebrenica and fears that Milosevic will become a martyr. More coming up here and now. Grievous charges against Slobodan Milosevic was the 1995 massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica. The UN-protected haven was overrun by Bosnian Serb militia supported by Milosevic. One of the survivors of that massacre is Muhammad Durakovic. Last year, on the 10-year anniversary of Srebrenica, he told us about the harrowing journey he and his father made through forests to escape the killing. Well, he joins us now on the line from Sarajevo. Muhammad, welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to speak with you again. And I'm just wondering, what was your first response when you heard that Milosevic had died?
Of course, you can never be happy with anybody passing away. And I was especially saddened by the news for the fact that Milosevic was so close to finally receiving his verdict and being sentenced for the crimes that he has committed. But somehow, by the twist of fate, he managed to escape that.
Are you convinced he would have been found guilty?
Yes, I'm absolutely convinced. And if you look at the the work and evidence that has been presented so far in the Hague Tribunal, there is absolutely no doubt that he would be convicted.
Given that you are disappointed that he was not completely tried, how do you feel about seeing the images we're seeing of Serbs holding Milosevic's photo in absolute reverence and standing up for him?
I would say that the same feeling that probably Jewish population had towards those Germans who are denying the Holocaust. And you still have people who are in denial of Holocaust half a century later. I mean, it's going to be a long struggle, and it's going to be a long battle for those survivors to actually try to break through to the majority of the Serb population and try to somehow, you know, prove to them or convince them of what horrible atrocities were committed.
It's interesting. I just want to comment, Muhammad, on the fact that here you are, a Muslim, identifying with Jews.
Well, I like to think of myself as a Bosnian Jew because the atrocities that Bosnian Jews endured in the Second World War are very much similar to atrocities that Bosnian Muslims have suffered in the past war here in 1995. And of course, if you look at the fate of Bosnian Jews, I mean, true Bosnian Jews in the war that took place until 1995 in Bosnia, we were on the same side. So therefore, it's very easy for me to identify myself with my Jewish friends.
We rarely hear that in, you know, some other places of the world. Well, Muhammad, what would you like to see now? I mean, there are some widows in Srebrenica who say they want a sentence in Milosevic's trial despite his death.
I think it's very important for this process to continue. Of course, the Hague Tribunal will stop the process because the man has passed away. However, documentation of the atrocities and documentation of his role in the atrocities should continue one way or another. I think that obviously that's not going to be the Hague Tribunal, but some sort of institution should continue on presenting evidence, gathering evidence, and putting this into some sort of a file where everybody who ever will be questioning events of 1992 to 1995 will be able to reference those documents and really, if willing to accept the truth, find the truth there.
The willingness is, I guess, the question. Do you think the people that we just spoke of holding Milosevic's pictures, do you think now that the trial, you know, has not been able to conclude, do you think that means that these people are not going to be convinced that genocide did happen?
Well, I'm very much I'm living and breathing Bosnia, so I know how people here see the passing away of Milosevic, especially Serb population. And I can tell you, a couple of days ago, I was listening to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke's statement on, and he made a similar statement to something like, I'm going to misquote him, but this is the end of one era, this is the end of Milosevic's era. Unfortunately, I must disagree with that one, and I think that Milosevic was a fascist that has been produced by fascism. It's not the Milosevic that made the Serbs into fascists. It's the Serbs, Serb fascists, who produced Milosevic. And now that Milosevic is gone, these people will still continue to vote for nationalist parties. And I think that there will be another a leader in Serbia that will continue on the legacy and the work and the project of Milosevic.
Muhammad Duraković, as Milosevic is buried, what will you be thinking about?
I will probably be thinking of all the people that have passed away in this horrible conflict that took place, all these men and women who did not deserve in any way to die, and now they are gone. I really see no point in what have happened, and it's completely, as any war probably is, it's completely pointless. I don't care about Milosevic. I don't care about what happened to him as much as I care about those people who are gone. What is important for me now is to focus on the products of his politics, and these products are the areas of Bosnia-Herzegovina which were ethnically cleansed, almost 50% of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And I think that the results of these projects should be reversed.
So you're saying bring Muslims back to Bosnia-Herzegovina?
That's the only way that I see a true Bosnia as a multi-ethnic society. Mm.
Did you ever think in your lifetime you'd be, you know, clawing your way through woods to get away from forces that were slaughtering people, you know, who looked like you?
Of course not. I never thought such a thing would take place. I went to primary school with these people. And to high school with these people, I knew so many of my friends of a Serb nationality that later on became on the opposite side. I never thought of it in that way. I never really saw them as the enemies. Even today, many of them that I meet, I do not see them as enemies. I just have a huge issue with the people who took part in the massacring of innocent civilians. And I think everybody who has committed any sort of crime should be brought to justice and punished for it. There were people who were just, you know, that just happened to be on opposite side of the front line, which does not make them criminals. This is not a process in which certain people should be punished. This is the process in which evidence should point at the truth, and the truth should point us toward the reconciliation. And this is why I think it's so important for us to continue on with this process of bringing up evidence of what happened in Srebrenica and other parts of Bosnia and Herzegovina, so we finally can start this long, painful process of reconciling with our neighbors.
Mohamed, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Mohamed Duraković, a survivor of the massacre at Srebrenica, where 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were killed in 1995. He spoke to us from Sarajevo. Slobodan Milosevic will be buried on Saturday. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WB.
The White House released its national security report today, with Iran vaulting to the top of the agenda. The White House also retained the right for a policy of preemptive military action. Well, our next guest has some cautionary thoughts. Retired Major General Robert Scales is a former commander at the Army War College. In general, you outlined a strategy for disarming Iran in January in a piece for the Washington Times. You say, unlike Iraq, there's no easy invasion of Iran. Why?
There's a huge difference. First of all, Iraq is a country that was cobbled together in the 1920s by European colonial powers. Iran is Persia, and they've been a homogenous state for almost 2,500 years. In addition, the population in Iran is three times that of Iraq. But most importantly, the biggest challenge in military operation in Iran is geography. The country is enormous. The Zagros Mountains that act as almost like a strategic perimeter around the capital of Tehran. These are mountains and ranges that are something akin to the Rockies and are an enormous military obstacle. The country is vast. It's three or four times the size of Iraq. So from a practical military standpoint, the phrase I would use is that the country using conventional means is virtually unassailable.
And yet there seems to be a contradiction for people not in the military. As you also write, they have very small armed forces, and their air force is particularly weak. They would lose to ours in less than a day of serious aerial combat.
That's right. I mean, they have, the best estimate is they have something like 50 operational fighter aircraft, and that's really about it. And so their ability to oppose an aerial strike by the United States is virtually negligible. So they really have no strong conventional military power, but what they do have is the will and the willingness to fight, and they have large numbers. Obviously, half the population is younger than 25, and so even though technologically they're fairly primitive in terms of conventional warfare, they still are a formidable military force on the ground.
You write that the opposition, the insurgency that the U.S. and coalition forces are meeting in Iraq, would pale in comparison to what they'd meet in Iran.
Oh, absolutely. You may recall in the 80s, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran and suffered several hundred thousand, some say as high as 500,000 casualties, and the most he was ever able to penetrate into Iran was to capture the Shatt al-Arab, which is that swampy area east of Basra. So, in a conventional sense, the whatever type of strategy this nation develops, the most risky and potentially the most painful would be a conventional invasion.
And yet, we want to rush to say that you also write: surely, if the finger of an Islamic fascist is placed on the nuclear button in Iran, some military action must be taken. So, what do you what kind of military action are you suggesting, if in fact it's needed?
Well, one military action that I don't agree with is the old proverbial shock and awe approach of just attempting to knock out Iran's nuclear capability with precision air power alone. We learned in the last war that that certainly didn't work against Iraq, and it would almost be counterproductive against Iran. First of all, it would do very little good, since we don't know precisely where the Iranians have hidden or will hide their nuclear weapons and their delivery systems. And secondly, it would actually, from a psychological point of view, work against us in the long run, because Iran would be able to claim that they were able to absorb a military strike by the United States. They would gain preeminence in the Arab world, and the rest of the world, the rest of the Arab world, would probably come to their defense, and the strategic result, I think, overall would be a minus rather than a positive.
Well, and you write this leaves only the airborne coup de main option. What is that?
This would be a military operation that would deliver ground maneuver forces into an area either on or nearby known or suspected nuclear weapon sites, and that would give time for special operating forces and conventional ground forces to find and destroy as much of the Iranian nuclear capability as possible, and then be able to withdraw back to a sanctuary without having to fight a long-term conventional war. So it's essentially a short war, a type of strategy that would seek to eliminate as much as possible Iran's nuclear weapons capability in as short a possible time. And of course, once the strike is made, it would be important, of course, to record everything to show that, in fact, Iran does have a weapons of mass destruction program underway, and they have developed delivery systems that would threaten Europe and the rest of the Middle East, and to include Israel. And that would take the psychological sting out of this operation, because we would be able to demonstrate to the rest of the world that, in fact, Iran did have this capability and they did pose a threat to the rest of the world.
Well, but yet we see a couple problems surfacing with that thinking. First of all, Colin Powell's former chief of staff recently said the U.S. intelligence apparatus is broken and we haven't got a clue about what's going on in Iran and wouldn't even know where to begin to do those surgical strikes.
He has an excellent point, and I agree with him completely. There are two points. First of all, in spite of my hypothesizing here, without question, the military option should be the last one that should be used in this situation. Every other means, to include economic, diplomatic, and political, should be exercised. And the second point is that an operation that I've just described to you is virtually impossible unless we do two things. First of all, we have to have far, far better intelligence about Iranian weapons of mass destruction programs, first of all. And secondly, this can't be a U.S.-only operation. It would have to involve as a minimum, NATO member nations and a much broader coalition that would coalesce and come together and commit themselves to removing the nuclear sting from Iran. And coalitions like this are not built quickly, and the intelligence apparatus is not anything that we could develop anytime soon.
Speaking of apparatus, you also say we don't have the sufficient physical apparatus, the right transport aircraft or light ground vehicles.
Yeah, unfortunately that's the sad part, is that for the last 50 years the military force that we have built isn't really suited for this new era of warfare, where the need is to reach in the far distant places to find an insurgent enemy who hides and goes to grounds and disperses and attempts to fight a distributed battle.
Like on the Afghan border.
Like on the Afghan border, like in Iraq, and perhaps potentially, who knows, in other places in the Middle East. Heavy European-style weapons that were optimized to fight the Soviet Union on the plains of Western Europe don't work well in these environments. And so we have to be able to, over the time, and very quickly, I would argue, build a military force that is much lighter. It's far more mobile. It relies more on networks to achieve lethal effects. But both the Army and the Marine Corps have a long way to go, because we've got 50 years to make up for with affecting the opinions and the will of the people. And that's something that simply can't be done by explosions alone.
That's retired Major General Robert Scales. He's president of ColGen, a defense consulting firm, former head of the Army War College. We're going to continue our talk with the general tomorrow about the possible diplomatic options to prevent a military strike, which he hopes is never used. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, tonight, college basketball's March Madness begins in earnest as first-round games are played in the NCAA men's tournament. And don't worry, we are not giving anything away. No BC score in case you want to go home and TiVo it tonight. The NCAA women's tournament begins this weekend as well. Here with a preview of both and a look at the World Baseball Classic. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield.
It's nice to be back, Robin.
Nice to see you as always. Now, Bill, a Chicago company has estimated that up to $3.8 billion could be lost in productivity as people follow these tournaments instead of working. You can watch them online now. This is in addition to the millions of dollars that are bet on the tournament every year in, you know, office pools. Not that any of us would participate. But this does seem to be the time of year when people who don't care about basketball care about basketball.
It does. And the only problem I have with those statistics is it seems to me that they assume that when it's not tournament time, people work without interruption and don't gamble. And I just can't quite believe that's the case.
Well, you got a point there. Well, some of the games being played as we speak in some parts of the country, and again, we're not giving any results because people, you know, then put pins in their eyes or something. But since we're here in Boston, we have to start with the Boston College Eagles, seeded fourth in the Minneapolis region. Oh, what a game they gave us last Sunday against Duke. Didn't win, but
2 points shy.
What do you think about them?
A great season after a horrible start. They lost their first three games against ACC opponents, and people were saying, gee, maybe they should have stayed in the Big East after all, but turned it around, had a great season, and they're in the tournament. And that's all we're going to say, right?
Well, except that I will say that they're in my Final Four just because I like them. You know, Gonzaga's in my Final Four because I like to say Gonzaga. But do you think they, I mean, might they go that far?
I'm absolutely not going to make predictions. If you asked me my favorite team for the Final Four, I like George Washington because they take a lot of heat for playing in what is allegedly a weak conference. They had an 18-game winning streak this season, and most importantly, they have a player named Pops Mensah-Bonsu. Pops Mensah-Bonsu. And any team with Pops Mensah-Bonsu coming back from a knee injury is all right with me.
Wait a minute. I might have to rejigger my Final Four. Okay, but the top seeds in the men's tournament are Duke, Villanova, Memphis, and Connecticut. So who else do you think might be unsung outside of those?
It's always impossible to say. The one thing that you can say about the both the men's side and the women's side of these tournaments is that somebody who nobody has regarded very highly will come out of nowhere and knock off somebody very good. The Harvard women's team years ago knocked off Stanford, and that was a magnificent achievement. I'm not sure we'll see anything quite that dramatic, but there will be drama and there will be upsets, and that's the fun of it.
Well, speaking of women, let's look at the women's tournament. Begins this weekend. Top seeds there: Duke, North Carolina, Ohio State, and LSU. Any surprises?
Well, Pat Summitt was certainly surprised that her Tennessee team didn't get a number one seed. She thought on the strength of schedule and on the fact that they had won the conference tournament, they should have been number one. And she pulled out the great defense of our time, Robin, which is no one respects us. And she went into the locker room and told her team, this is a slap in the face to you.
Ah.
So look for Tennessee to come out and win all their games by 65 points.
Perhaps slapping people. Well, you know, for a long time, the criticism of the women's tournament was that there was this huge disparity between the top teams and everyone else. Is there more parity now?
There's definitely more parity now. I mean, the relative strength of teams like Connecticut and Tennessee now are pretty good indications of that, because there are more good female basketball players than there ever were before. Not only more scholarships at the college level and more programs, more colleges taking the sport seriously, but more youth programs for girls all the time, and better coached and better training and all the rest of it. That's paying off.
Okay, we just got a minute left. The World Baseball Classic, the U.S. team plays Mexico tonight. Roger Clemens pitching for the U.S., and they have to win to make the semifinals.
They have to win to make the semifinals. If they don't win, the four teams in the semifinals will be Cuba against the Dominican Republic in one matchup and Korea against Japan in the other, and the U.S. will be watching on TV.
How embarrassing.
Well, I don't think so, because most of the players on a lot of the other teams, not Japan and Korea, but certainly the DR and some of the other teams, Venezuela, are guys who play in the major leagues.
Right.
So no embarrassment there.
Our guys, not all of them showed up. Well, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. He'll be talking baseball, basketball, and, you know, world affairs, given that it's Bill. On only a sport, it's only a game this week, so catch him. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Celebrated modern dance choreographer Mark Morris rarely creates new works for dance companies other than his own, which, by the way, celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. But Mark Morris has created a new dance for Boston Ballet. It premieres tonight and is intriguingly entitled Up and Down. Even more intriguing, this ballet is set not to orchestral music, but to a saxophone quartet. Here Now's Lynn Menegon recently sat in on Mark Morris's first music rehearsal for Up and Down. He'd never met the musicians before, and no dancers were present. Lynn witnessed an unusual collaboration.
Wow. I'm turning red sympathetically. There's a lot of air blowing out of all those scales, right? Like it's like a slow leak. Like you don't get to produce sound with all of it. Some of it just escapes forever. As I said to the dancers, it's like farting in the bathtub. Sorry, don't take that personally, but the sort of lightness of it. I'm more interested in the big beats of four to be in time. I don't mind if the scales are, the scales can float more. It gets a little bit martial.
This one's a little too didactic
then,
a little too...
I would never have said didactic, but yes. It's a little. It can be a little less strict. It can swing a little bit more. How about that?
Now you're in my vernacular. Okay. That's good. I don't didactic. I don't know if I'm insulted or not.
My name's Tom Ferranti.
And your instrument is formally called the?
It's a soprano saxophone. It's the top voice of the saxophone quartet.
Have you ever done anything like this before, worked with dancers?
Nothing quite like this, no, with him. He sure knows music. I've had a lot of experience in music, 50 years of it, and this is one of the highlights.
Boston Ballet conductor Jonathan McPhee has known Mark Morris since the early 1980s, when, back then, Morris was known as the bad boy of the New York dance scene.
You know, I'd sort of heard of him, Mark Morris Dance Company in New York, but was totally unprepared for the guy that showed up in the studios in cutoffs, a torn T-shirt, cigarette in one hand, drink in the other hand, and just... he looked like a wild man and started working with the dancers. And, you know, one thing that's held true over the many years of watching him work, the exterior that you see, you don't have to be with him too long before you realize that actually he cares intensely. He works very hard. He has a lot to say.
I don't want to really a rallentando until the last, like, bar and a half.
Now, the appeal, I think, is something that's very interesting to have watched over the years, because traditionally a modern choreographer appeals to a very small audience. There have been two exceptions that I can think of in the last 50, 60 years. Martha Graham and Mark Morris. And there's a good reason that they have appealed to a larger audience. When you go to a Mark Morris dance event these days, you will see the diehard Mark Morris dance fans. You'll see classical ballet people. What's more important is you'll see music people who show up. Now, music people are notoriously difficult to get into the dance realm. So why the appeal? Why is he larger than what you would expect? It's the musicality.
Yeah. I was thinking of other things, but...
You did. That's great.
The articulation. Yeah. You want the articulation more clear there.
Exactly. It also, some of these pages in the finale also start to sound like just the long way to get into the right key. Mm-hmm. You know, it gets a little bit fillery sounding if it's so... It just gets a little bit washy. So if we have these little sub-beats, it's more interesting. And they'll dance better. They'll be able to hear it better. But that's great.
a brilliant choreographer makes you listen to the music in a way that you would not normally have listened to it. And I think about Martha, first of all, because she's the one that started me in the dance field. I used to be amazed at watching how she would choreograph with the dancers a line that was almost missing from the score. In other words, if you had an orchestra score and it had all the different instruments in it, it's almost as if she wrote another instrument line in the score that had visual rhythm, to the point where sometimes when she choreographed something, she was so in tune with the music that she could actually do a movement that would make you think you heard a note that wasn't there. And Mark does the same kind of thing. He actually works from the inside of the music out so that you actually will react more intensely to the score.
Good. You know, I want it to be like the national anthem of some place we don't know the name of. But what I like is that it goes da-da-da-da-da, and it's like a trick loop that it started over.
Sometimes he's been criticized for having too slavish a response to the music. Do you think that that's true?
No, I don't really agree with that. There are times when he does things to the music that I really don't like. And that's okay. I mean, there are lots of pieces of music I don't like, and I'm a musician. That's fine. So I think the criticism, well, everybody's open to criticism, but the important thing is that here is somebody who consistently makes you notice the music.
Less of a retard. This is really like the folk tune from somewhere we've never been. You
know, so, and that's really a genius?
Yeah, that's a word I really, rarely use. Martha was a genius. Leonard Bernstein was a genius. I think Mark Morris is right up there. He's one of the few choreographers I know who can actually build steps that have enough flexibility to be able to give musical latitude to a performance. You know, so many times you run into choreographers today who only work with a CD, which is one fixed result. The ones who have had little experience with live music will say, I want it just like my CD, you know, which just, you know, is like a knife in the heart of every musician.
Boston Ballet premieres Mark Morris's Up and Down tonight. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And by the way, this terrific music is composed by Alexander Glazunov. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.